call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It's 1:35 on Wednesday, the first day of March. We have Senator Meyer with us, and Senator Costello with us, and Chair Coghill. Today we have before us Senate Bill 54. I do expect the other two members to come along. I hadn't heard that they weren't going to be here, put it that way. So I'll just notice them when they come before us. We had Senate Bill 54 before us previously. I said that we would bring a CS, and so what I'd like to do is have Senator Costello make a motion to adopt the CS. I'll object. I'll have my staff go through what the changes are, and then we'll begin some testimony with the administration, and then we'll go to public testimony given time. Senator Costello.
Mr. Chair, I move CS for Senate Bill Number 54, Judiciary Version 30-LS0461/O in front of the committee as the working document.
Thank you, and I'll object so that we can hear the differences, and I'll have Jordan Schilling, my staff, go through the changes. He has them lined out, it looks like, in order of change and not in order of all policy calls. So, Mr. Schilling.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. In the members' packets, there's a document titled Summary of Changes. It's version A to version O, which is in front of the committee. And the first change that can be found in the bill is in section 5. So the commission recommended the sex trafficking changes that are contained within Senate Bill 54. However, in addition to those changes that are already in the bill, the commission also recommended there be a definition for the word compensation. And because the commission did not give very specific guidance on the exact language of that definition, sponsor's office reached out to the Department of Law and the public defender to get together and reach consensus on a definition that would meet the goals of the commission's recommendations. And they submitted that language to the sponsor, and that definition can be found in section 5. It simply reads, compensation does not include any payment for reasonably apportioned shared expenses. So any use of the word compensation in the bill, specifically sections 3 and 4, just know that the word compensation has its own definition for the purposes of that section.
Hang on, Jordan. So welcome, Senator Wilkowski. Senator Wilkowski, we have brought before us the version O for Senate Bill 54, and we're on the summary of change explanation. It has not been adopted yet. It's just before us under motion. And you'll see in your packet that we started with Section 5, which deals with the amended definition of compensation the issue we're dealing with under the promoting prostitution question. Are you with us?
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Jordan, please continue.
Mr. Chairman, the next change, the next deviation from the last version of the bill can be found in Section 6. And while the commission recommended up to 90 days of active imprisonment for a C felony that is a first felony conviction, the CS increases the active term of imprisonment that may be imposed for a C felony that is a first felony conviction from 0 to 90 to 0 to 120 days.
And just for the committee's benefit, what I'd like to do is when we have the Department of Law and the public defenders, they will kind of share with us how they arrive at different ways, and at that point I think we can have our own debate based on some of the input we've got. But this is a little bit even further beyond the recommendation of the commission, just to let you know. It was easier to, I think, go down that road than it was to try to decide what was violent and nonviolent. We were to get into kind of a legal no man's land on that if we tried to do that. So this is a way of giving courts that discretion, I think. So please continue, Jordan.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. The next section of the bill that is new is Section 7. As you'll recall, the commission recommended that there be some modicum of supervision for felony sex offenders, but the commission did not specify what the actual minimums should be. They just said there should be some minimums. And so we reached out to, again, the public defender and the Department of Law to get feedback about what would be appropriate minimums. The public defender submitted numbers to us. The Department of Law submitted numbers to us. And the bill sponsor ultimately decided to go with the higher Department of Law numbers, and those can be found in Section 7. What Section 7
before
does...
Before you go any further, just to welcome Senator Kelly. And Senator Kelly, we're under the summary of changes under Section 7, right? Section 7 of the bill. Okay. And so just to let everybody know, also... the Department of Law and Public Defender will be able to speak to these issues, and I think we need to hear once again the discussion on this. This is one of those policy calls that we have professionals in the area coming up with different views. We need to make a policy call, that's all. And I started with the 120 days. Please continue, Jordan.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And so to explain the minimums that the Department of Law proposed that we in turn included in this CS are as follows. For an unclassified sex felony, 15 years would be the minimum. 15 years is also the maximum, so that would create somewhat of a definite term of probation. For an A felony and a B felony sex offense, the minimum would be 10 years, which would then create a range of 10 to 15 years. And then for a C felony sex offense, the minimum is 5 years in the CS, which would create a range of 5 to 15 years.
So my apologies to the committee. I slipped. I always call it a cogwheel. I reverted back to Section 6 when I said 120 days. My apologies. Please continue.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. The next major change in this CS can be found in Section 8. So this one requires a little bit of history. Last year, a member of the other body introduced a floor amendment to Senate Bill 91, which enhanced the penalty for the B misdemeanor version of distributing an explicit image of a minor. The B misdemeanor version of that conduct is sending an explicit image of a minor to one other person. But the amendment did not also enhance the penalty for the arguably worse conduct, which is the A misdemeanor version of that conduct, which is rather than sending that photo to one person, posting that photo on an internet website that's available to the public.
Let me interrupt you for a second. Senator, you need some paper? Since I have my staff aide at the desk to testify, if there's anything I can do to help you. Okay. All right. Got it. All right. And by the way, since you're bringing that up, I will ask the department to not only talk to us about that fiscal note, but at the end, if what these changes they will have to contemplate on a fiscal note, I would intend to bring them up to speak to that issue. So please continue. So did everybody get that since I interrupted him right at the end? Everybody get that the explicit image was adding, if you go broader, it carries a similar penalty? Would you please remind us again?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just to reiterate, last year, while Senate Bill 91 was moving through the other body, there was an amendment that increased the maximum sentence for distributing an explicit image of a minor to one other person. That was enhanced to provide for up to 90 days in prison. But the arguably worse conduct of taking that same image and posting it on a publicly available website remains sentenceable up to 30 days, provided that was their first conviction for that offense. So there's a disparity where the arguably lesser offense is punishable by more than the arguably worse offense. And so this eliminates that disparity by enhancing the conduct where you would post that image on a website.
Okay.
I should add, too, Mr. Chairman, this is a commission recommendation. The next change is in Section 10. These are really technical changes. It simply revises the language relating to theft in the fourth degree and similar offenses to comport with the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission's recommendations that A, probation term lengths be clarified, and B, that third and subsequent theft for offenses and similar offenses be punishable by up to 10 days in prison. This is really a technical change just to comport exactly to what the commission recommended.
Thank you.
Section 11 is also another conforming change that requires notice to the opposing party if the state seeks to establish the new aggravating factor that this bill creates. If the state seeks to establish the aggravator that's created earlier in the bill, which the commission recommended, there needs to be a process for them to provide notice to the opposing party. Section 12 of the bill creates a Section 12 of the bill creates a look-back period for the purposes of counting priors, for the purposes of establishing the new A misdemeanor aggravator. Because we have aggravating factors that require there be previous convictions, it makes sense to establish a look-back period. And there is already a look-back period for our felony sentencing framework. It's a 10-year look-back period. And we chose 5 years not arbitrarily for the misdemeanor look-back period. There is already one A misdemeanor that has a 5-year look-back period. It's DV Assault 4. And it made sense to simply extend that look-back period to all A misdemeanors. I should add to Mr. Chairman that there are some offenses that are excluded from this look-back period. In other words, there are some offenses that have an infinite look-back period. Those are unclassified felonies and A felonies. So in other words, if an individual were convicted of an unclassified felony even 20 years ago, it's still relevant for the purposes and still counts towards counting priors for these aggravators.
So we're just talking about misdemeanors in this particular case.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Questions? All right, move on.
The next change is the addition of Section 15 to the bill. Section 15 reduces the crime of no valid operator's license to an infraction. And so this is, again, an attempt to correct a disparity created by Senate Bill 91. Senate Bill 91 made driving with a suspended license, and the reason for the suspension is something other than a DUI, so points, for example. It reduced that offense to an infraction, but Senate Bill 91 did not similarly reduce the crime of no valid operator's license to an infraction. And so, again, we have a situation where arguably lesser conduct, simply driving without your license, but the reason you don't have your license is not because you committed a criminal offense, it's just you just do not have it for whatever reason. That is an A misdemeanor. And so in order to eliminate that disparity, we need to make NVOL no valid operator's license an infraction. And again, this was a commission recommendation. The next change is Section 17. It's really a grammatical change. This is the section that clarifies which defendants the Department of Corrections shall conduct a risk assessment on. And what the commission recommended this year was that individuals who are A, cited rather than physically arrested, and B, individuals who are released on the bail schedule shall not receive a risk assessment, and there's very good reasons for this. But we used the term brought into custody in the bill, and that's a legal term that created some confusion as to what it specifically meant. And so at the advice of the court system, we have changed this language to read, rather than brought into custody, to be more specific and say detained in custody in a correctional facility following arrest. Finally, Section 18 requires the Department of Corrections to present the results of the pretrial risk assessment to not only the court, which they are already required to present the results to, but to also give the results of the pretrial risk assessment to the defendant and to the prosecutorial authority. I should say, Mr. Chairman, that the Department of Corrections has some concerns with this section, and there's kind of a question as to who should be responsible for giving this score. There's some thought that maybe the courts might be more appropriate, and so I just wanted to add that prior to Department of Corrections coming up.
And we'll let them talk to it, but the reason we set it off in this direction was they're the originator of the risk assessment and its disposal. So that would be the first reason. Then we'll listen intently to figure out if that's the best way to do it. That's all.
So those are all the changes.
So we've gone through this. I don't have a fiscal note for this at this point, but I'd still like to adopt this. So if there's no other objection, I'll remove my objection to the old version and bring it before us. You've had a chance to ask your questions. So that brings the, seeing no objection, that will bring the committee substitute for Senate Bill 54 Judiciary version O, dated 2/27/17, before us. And what I'd like to do is open it up to testimony from those departments concerned. We have Nancy Mead that will probably come up first, but I'll just go through the list and tell you who we have available. I'm going to have Commissioner Monaghan from the Department of Public Safety come before us, but we do have Tony Piper with the Alcohol Safety Action Program with us for questions, and then I have some folks from Priceless who are online who also want to testify. And for those of you listening in Anchorage that want to testify, Stephanie Staveland and Donna Thompson, what I'm going to do is I'm going to run through the bill with the departments and have them give their testimony, and I will do everything I can to get to you. We have about an hour, so we should be able to move expeditiously. If for some reason we can't, I hope that you will either give us your written testimony or join us on Friday, where my intention is to take much more public comment. So with that, I would like to have Nancy Mead. Are you? Yes, thank you, Nancy. Just to the overview of some of the documents, and also we have, by the way, we have Tara Burns from the Community United for Safety and Protection here that also, and the same thing will stand, that if we run over, I hope you're here, are available on Friday. But I wanted to get the view of this bill from the various different agencies so that we know how does it work, does it work well. And none of them have been surprised by this bill. They've all had a chance to look at it. They've all had their input into it. And like Jordan said, we've tried to figure out where we could start the discussion, and maybe we landed in the right spot. So with that, Nancy Mead with the court system, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. And for the record, I am Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I will be speaking to version O itself. I'm happy to answer any questions, of course. Preliminarily, I want to say that we did prepare a zero fiscal note. This will not have fiscal impact on us changing sentences, sentence lengths, and things like that. Doesn't change our resources or our use of judges. So that we had a little bit of difficulty uploading it, but it's there and or will be in the appropriate place soon. Sorry about that. And I won't speak to every section of the bill, but would be happy to answer questions. But the ones that the court system was more involved in, I will address. And the first two of those are the first two sections of the bill, violating conditions of release. And we spoke about this at the last meeting, I believe. And this has been one of the more difficult areas of SB 91 for the court system and others in the criminal justice system to implement and get their arms around, really. Violating conditions of release was changed by SB 91 to be a violation. That means there can be no jail time. However, it was still something that somebody could get arrested for. It is, I should speak in the present tense, under SB 91. But when that person is taken to the jail or to a detention facility, there was a lot of confusion about whether they could be held. If this was a non-jailable offense, how really can we hold the person to have something more happen with their underlying bail conditions. The presiding judges did amend our bail form to have a sentence after a few months added that says if a person violates any of these conditions, they shall be held to have another bail review hearing. And that may or may not be working in every situation, but that was the court system's solution. That again, the commission, Criminal Justice Commission, did recommend this change, changing it back into a crime to ensure that those people who are arrested for this conduct could be held for a short period. Now, Sections 1 and 2 of Version O have as their corresponding punishment section Section 9, and that specifies that this will be a crime, a B misdemeanor, but the maximum time that can be held is 5 days. And that's a time within which they would have another bail hearing in front of the court on the underlying claim and charge. I also want to say that these violating conditions of release is different from violations of probation or technical things you might do in probation. The most common violating conditions of release, or some common ones, are this is when somebody's let out on bail, and here are the things that you can't do while you're out on bail before your hearing. Contacting the victim is a very common one, or drinking to excess or consuming alcohol if the underlying charge was alcohol-related, so that when a law enforcement officer knows that you've committed one of these actions and that was something you were not supposed to do, that's generally, very generally, what a VCOR is. And that's why the person needs to be held, because they, at least allegedly, were not able to adhere to the conditions under which the court released them. So that's how VCOR works, and this was, again, a recommendation of the commission, Sections 1 and 2. I'll skip the policy-laden discussion that you guys will have about the sex trafficking statutes and the appropriate penalty for a C felony. That's for this branch to determine. And I will move on to Section 8 of the bill. Section 8 is something that that did arise as, again, we implemented SB 91. These are the terms of imprisonment that are permissible for Class A misdemeanors. And if you look at page 4 of the of Version O, you can see the outline basically has, on line 2, subsection 1, 1 year if it's one of these A through E things, and now you'll add a new 2, 60 days if it's that, and then the default for A misdemeanor is 30 days. So generally it's 30, but now moving up on the page, because that's how this has been drafted, you would be adding through this bill 60 days, so an enhanced penalty for a person's second a misdemeanor if it's similar in nature to the prior ones. And the way this arose is mostly it came to my attention through questions from judges, and we put out there, here are the new laws, and it seemed to be slightly anomalous to some folks, especially in the context of a second DUI. So a second DUI is an A misdemeanor, and there are minimums that are required in the DUI statute. For second DUI, the minimum is 20 days in prison. And without this addition you're making, the new subsection 2, the maximum would be 30 days. And that was a very narrow window compared to what people had been used to. It used to be 20 days minimum, but up to a year. So by ratcheting everything down, it may have been, you could view it as an oversight, you could view it as something that was unforeseen as being a potential issue that people thought maybe needed a little bit of more room in. So now, if this should pass, the permissible range for a second DUI would be 20 days up to 60 days. And that's just one example. This allows 60 days for any second time a misdemeanor, and then you're up to the full year possible for a third time. And this arose, and this is a little bit really instructive for everyone, including the judges and everybody. If you look at line 9, your SB 91 said that it would be 1 year if the defendant has past criminal convictions. Well, there was a lot of discussion and cases decided about whether convictions was you needed two or more, or whether it meant really a past previous conviction. And at least one judge decided that you needed two or more. And you can see why, because it's plural, but yeah. Something like that caused quite a bit of vagueness with practitioners and judges. So I think you could view this as more or less a clarifying thing. Whether the 60 days is appropriate or not is, of course, your policy call, but clarifying what happens with a second time would be helpful for us and probably others. Commons. The next one is, well, Section 9 I already highlighted. That's where you'll see the limit of 5 days on page 5, line 4, for the violating conditions of release. I explained that a few moments ago. Section 10, and especially around line 17, addresses something that that also was probably unforeseen. This is the penalty provision for the lower level thefts, the B misdemeanor, and related theft type offenses of items that are less than $250. But the one question that had come up was whether any probation could be ordered, and I think Mr. Schilling earlier explained how judges and lawyers have rules for statutory interpretation that led at least some people to believe that unless it was specified that you could have probation ordered, there was possibly the interpretation that no probation was permitted. And it was the sponsor's intent that there ought to be that as an option in sentencing those low-level theft offenders, and therefore that addition was, I believe, clarifying that you could view it that way. Section 11 was also something that I guess I brought to the sponsor's office's attention, and this is really a procedural thing that probably wouldn't be very important to a lot of people, but it would be important to the court system and the lawyers in there who have to figure out how to actually procedurally put some of these aggravators into practice and what happens. And all it says is that if you're talking about that, this is a second misdemeanor or a third or subsequent, that's that determination that puts you in the category of a higher possible jail term can be decided by the court, as opposed to something that is more fact-laden. For example, whether this is one of the most serious types of misdemeanors, that sort of thing by old case law is decided by a jury. So this this is, I would submit, not controversial, but very helpful to have that put in there in Section 11. Section 12, I believe Mr. Schilling fully addressed, and I don't have a position on that one. Section 15 is the next one I will flip to. That looks like a very short section, and you wonder what it does. But as Mr. Schilling mentioned, when you last year changed in SB 91, the penalties for driving with license suspended or revoked, which is a very commonly charged offense in this jurisdiction, you made it an infraction unless the person was driving with a license suspended after a DUI or refusal. Then it's a misdemeanor, and so we aren't really talking about that. But if lots of DWLSs, which is what we call them, are infractions, which means that the maximum penalty is $300, that's it, no jail, it didn't make sense probably to leave intact the existing law that, frankly, I think the commission didn't notice. If you never went and got your license, you just aren't a person that ever went and got licensed, that was more severe. That was a misdemeanor, and it was punishable by up to 90 days in jail. So there was a little bit of an anomaly there or a discrepancy, and I believe the sponsor's office and the commission viewed this as something that would bring that oddity more in line with maybe what it should be. And so that was recommended. Section 16 is something I've talked about previously, and this is probably going to be viewed as very helpful by the municipalities, but what happened in SB 91 was what we all came to call the Section 113 problem, and I think it was in SB 91 that it said that municipalities couldn't have any punishments that were more severe than state punishments. And that's fine, but I think what maybe many people overlooked then is that the municipalities have fines for things that the state also has fines for. And sometimes municipalities' fines are higher, and they did not want those to be impacted, and it was seen as something that was probably not intended by the Criminal Justice Commission nor by this body to cause those fines to have to be decreased. What you probably did want was to not let municipalities fill the jails with people when you weren't filling the jail. So it was probably intended more in the prison terms. So this clarifies, by changing the word offense to crime, which you might not think is a very big change, that is a clarifying amendment that says that minor offenses, which are basically the traffic tickets and other offenses that are defined in regulations and then also in municipal ordinances would not be included in this provision. So that's why that's in there, I believe. Finally, I'll address Section 18. And
me too.
This arises in the context of that new pretrial services office, which isn't happening yet, but will become, its changes become effective in January. Now, they are actively working on how to implement this, and there's a couple of work groups making sure under the guidance of the pretrial services officer, who was hired recently by the Department of Corrections, making sure that they can do this in time, and it's an awful lot of work. One of the issues that arose during the context of those implementation meetings is how this report that they're going to do on everybody who's arrested will get out there. And so last year's SB 91 says that the pretrial risk assessment that they do will be presented to the court. And in the context of those meetings, there were some discussions about, well, what about the parties? How will they get it? And I understand that the Department of Corrections might not be in favor of this change, and certainly whatever change you make is okay, but it seems that the attorneys need to have that report before the hearing. So this occurs when somebody's arrested, say, at 11 p.m., and they're going to be arraigned the next morning by 9 a.m., and the pretrial services office has the task of conducting an assessment on that person, creating a report, and then getting it to the appropriate people. SB 91 says the court, but it appears that the attorneys would want those reports as well, because the court only reacts to what attorney says, and they would need to see what's in there because they're representing clients at that time, and they would want to create their arguments about whether to accept the recommendations or not. So the change here would have the pretrial services office email that report not just to the court, but also to the prosecution and to the public defender, the defense attorney, if known. And I don't mean to step on any toes, and if that's something the Department of Corrections is not able to do, and if that's still under discussion, that's fine. I had thought that was not terribly controversial, but I maybe it is. So anyhow, that's the only reason that change appears now, and obviously,
and we brought it in because we thought it was appropriate. And I think the question is how to implement this, once again.
And just to quickly address the question that Mr. Schilling and the chairman brought up before, whether the court should distribute those reports is something that I can talk to with that pretrial services implementation group. Actually, it has been discussed, but it's not we'll try to figure out the most efficient way to do that. I mean, I have reasons why it might not be so efficient or effective for the court to do it, because the parties need that document at the same time, at least, as the court gets it, if not before. But again, I don't want to undermine anything that the Department of Corrections wants to say about that.
This is indicative of how down into the detail we've been able to look at the implementation of some of the justice work we're doing is right down to who talks to who, almost. So for that, I'm grateful. Thank you very much. Is there questions for Nancy at this point, Senator Meyer?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Nancy, for that explanation. Just a couple questions, and again, being new to the Judiciary Committee, these may seem like elementary questions, but on Section 10, where you talk about, is that called petty theft, if it's $250 or less?
That, yes, I know what you mean by that, Senator Meyer.
So if I understand, Seb, I've stolen less than $250 twice. I still do not have any jail time. Am I reading that correctly?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, if you look at Section 10 and we're in L2, that's the subparagraph that applies if it's your first or second time being convicted of one of those low-level thefts. That's correct. So if it's your second time, you're in subparagraph 2, and you cannot get active jail time, but you can now, with the change there on line 17, be sentenced to a probationary term of up to 6 months.
Okay. Thank you for that explanation. I think a lot of times it's these small thefts that are the most frustrating to people. I don't know if it warrants jail time or not. I guess that's a question for another time. Do you have is there like a look back phase on these? You know, like when you say if it's the third time in so many years, if somebody has been caught, say, two times, and then 10 years later they get their third time, is there kind of a look back period in there?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, this new CS version O on page 8 would add a very specific look back period so that for these misdemeanors, it's all the language starting on line 6 on page 8, it would be, it's generally a 5-year look back period.
Okay, great.
And that was added just in this CS.
I think that's primarily, though, to B misdemeanors, right? I mean, A misdemeanors, right? In fact, we'll have to double-check on that, because Jordan just told me that he thinks that it's only on one set of misdemeanors. So we can have the Department of Law also bring that up.
Okay, I'm sorry if I misspoke then.
Okay. No, that's one of the reasons why I have really good staff.
Yeah. And then, Mr. Chairman, if I can just one more quick question. When you say a minimum of 20 days in jail for, I think, was that a Class A misdemeanor or second offense?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, that was an example I used for DUI, that specific A misdemeanor.
Okay, here's where I'm very naive. So when you say minimum of 20 days, oftentimes you hear people getting sentences for a certain length of time, but then they get out for good behavior or for some other reason. Is that still the case, or when you say minimum 20 days, it means minimum 20 days?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, and these are good questions. the 20 days for the DUI, I think the good time deduction that you get, you don't get it if the sentence is under 10 days. It is my thinking, and DOC can correct me, that good time deductions do apply for things for a 20-day, the one-third off. But again, they would be the more appropriate person to address that specific question.
Thank you.
So I've got about 45 minutes left. And we need to move this thing along as rapidly as we can, but I don't want to minimize the testimony. Thank you very much,
Thank
Nancy.
You.
So I've got the Department of Law here, and they didn't get to hear the first part of this. We did adopt the version O of the bill, just for your information. And so the only testimony to date has been, at this point, the court system. I do have the Department of Corrections here. Are you able to stick around to the end at this point, Department of Law?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
And I will have you up after the Department of Corrections. So if I could have the Department of Corrections come forward at this point. And any help that you need, Commissioner, and just give us your testimony, your high-level look at this. Certainly, I don't know. I think at the end I would like to have you speak to the fiscal note. The only reason is because I want the Department of Law and Department of the Public Defenders to give us their view of this particular version before we start talking about it, because it may be up for discussion at a different level. So, but we do have the fiscal note at this point, and I know that if this bill stays the way it is, it would have some impact. So I'd like to address that at the end. At this point, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
All right, thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Dean Williams, I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Corrections. So, Mr. Chairman, I just, you know, became aware of version L recently, as well as all of you have, and I guess maybe I'll just cut to the chase and sake of time. You know, we need to analyze the proposals in this bill. I'll just say this, that it's a policy call, clearly, where the committee and where all of you want to go in regards to proposed changes that are before us. From my perspective, and as the commissioner, any changes in result in increased incarceration, whether or not we love the reasons or hate the reasons or whatever, is going to have an impact on my department.
Sure.
My budget has been set with the expectations and a calculation in place that the
reduction in incarceration for the crimes that were being discussed in Version O. We're not going to be there, so anything that comes back in is going to be an increase. It just is. And there are some, and so I'll answer questions about that, but I feel a lot better once we able to cobble together a fiscal note. And I know you've asked me off the record to see if we can get that by Friday. I'll see if my staff can jam to get that done. I think that would clarify some of the conversations about what the costs are going to be in terms of changing course on these policy calls. And so that that's just the facts, Mr. Chairman. There are a few other things here we were mentioned in terms of the technical pieces. I don't know if you want me to comment about that.
Please do.
Well, this is sort of the smaller issues, but it is one that concerns me, as Nancy Mead alluded to. Getting in the weeds about how we're going to even deliver the risk assessment tool to multiple, to several different players, not just the court, all these little details really does cause me concern for a couple reasons. One, many times the attorney, as I understand, and I have lawyers in the room, not me, but are not appointed until the arraignment. So what attorney to get it to when the risk assessment is done, what we expect to do out of that, and who's going to get appointed to where seems to be naturally set with the court, because that's when the parties show up, and whether or not you have an attorney or not you're representing yourself, and that's where that's decided. The second thing is that part of doing the risk assessment and the strategy behind the whole pretrial effort is to have a lot of partners involved in this effort with us. So community jails, local law enforcement agencies who can do the risk assessment tool and get it in. And so I want to make it as clean and as clear as possible for them. So that may or not be a problem, but quite frankly, I haven't analyzed the think through about how it might affect our partners now.
Commissioner, you might just shed a little light on your pretrial working group, who all is involved in it, to give us some concept. And maybe we would take this out of this particular version to let you come up with a better way. But at this point, we needed to bring it open for discussion.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I completely respect that, and I get that. My pretrial director has literally everybody who remotely has a hand in this issue of standing up the pretrial unit at the table. And so I would certainly appreciate the ability to allow that team to continue to formulate the plan, including when it's done, where it goes to, how do we make it sure to get to the relevant individuals. And if we really find there's a glaring glitch at the end of that, then I guess I'd feel better about addressing it in statute later. But I'd appreciate the opportunity for that work group to really continue the process and to stand up the unit and the particulars from the unit.
All right, well taken. Continue.
I guess I don't have...
So then maybe, Mr. Commissioner, I know that I have Department of Law and the Public Defender in town. Right. I may not get them
I agree.
Long. So maybe we should go ahead and get them up, and then as you ponder how you can give us kind of the parting look at how you might put a fiscal note together.
Correct.
And if we have to, we can deal with it on Monday. So there's some flex points, but you know, the clock is ticking pretty loud here as well.
Sure.
And I'd like to move this along, but I don't want to move it along with questions that really we should be able to answer. So
right.
If you don't mind, we can go ahead and have the Department of Law come forward. And we also, by the way, we have the Division Director of Administrative Services with you as part of your backup, so it's nice to have the Department of Corrections got lots of help here. Today, though, we're going to go ahead and have the Department of Law come forward. We have John Skidmore and Clint, right?
Yes, sir.
Clint, is it Campion?
Yes, sir.
Thank you for coming before. I know that we're running you from one committee to the other, and you get to switch gears almost as you're walking down the hall. But we did adopt version O. I had Mr. Schilling go through the changes. And first, let's make sure we get the big policy calls dealt with in case we run out of time. And then we can go down into the other details if we have to. We can always do some of those on the phone along the way. Mr. Skidmore.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senators. For the record, my name is John Skidmore. I'm the Director of the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. Seated here at the table with me is Clint Campion, who's the District Attorney for the Anchorage office, obviously the office that represents three of the Senators here in the room. I first would like to thank Senator Coghill for sponsoring SB 54 and the committee for taking the time to consider what we consider to be a few amendments, tweaks to SB 91. But even those small changes can have significant impacts overall to the criminal justice system. And so we think it's important to look at those things. The reason we've asked Mr. Campion to be here is for those big policy issues that the Chairman, Senator Coghill, asked us to talk about. We wanted to be able to share with you all very briefly, very concisely, some of what we're seeing on the front lines with some of those policy calls so that you more fully understand when those changes are made here in SB 91, exactly what we're trying to get to. And so with that, I'm going to actually ask Mr. Campion to talk about three of those policy areas, and then I'll talk about the changes in the policy calls in SB 54.
Good afternoon. I'm Clint Campion, the Anchorage District Attorney, and the Attorney General asked me to come down and address some the concerns that or observations that I've made. So there's three areas. One are the violating conditions of release, which you've obviously heard about. Second is the Class C felonies, and third are theft in the fourth degree. Let me, I guess, start in reverse order. The Anchorage District Attorney's Office is not primarily responsible for prosecuting misdemeanor offenses in the municipality of Anchorage. The Municipal Prosecutor's Office primarily handles that, but the Anchorage District Attorney's Office is responsible for the Aleutian Islands, the Bristol Bay area, and the Pribilof Islands. So we do prosecute theft, low-level theft cases regularly, just not as much in the municipality. What I can tell you anecdotally is the police officers that I interact with on a regular basis inform me that they are hearing from suspected thieves that they are being told things like, just give me a citation and let me go. I know you can't take me to jail. And that's caused frustration for law enforcement officers that I deal with because of that concept, real or imagined. And so that's my observation about the theft in the fourth degree. Regarding violations of conditions of release, I would echo what Ms. Mead said, which is that there has been a great deal of confusion within our office with judicial officers and with law enforcement officers about what they are to do when they are confronted by someone that they know or suspect has violated their conditions of release. We've tried to work through that and explain to the officers what the remedy might be, and in some cases it's been successful. But what it causes is if a judicial officer is unwilling or unable to remand someone on a violation of conditions of release, or the officer is confused about what to do, and if we receive that information, our recourse is to ask the court to schedule a hearing. Just yesterday, I received a phone call from someone who said, I'm a third-party custodian for someone who's charged with felony DUI. He's not following the rules. I want to be relieved as a third-party custodian. There was a great deal of confusion about what she was to do. She called the police agency. They weren't exactly sure what to do, whether that allowed them to go pick up that person at that residence. So our recourse was to ask the court to schedule a bail hearing. That bail hearing was scheduled. I understood it was scheduled for today, and then it was rescheduled because there was a lack of notice to the defense attorney and the defendant. So that person is in violation of conditions of release from our perspective and has not been before a judicial officer to have their bail re-examined. The other related point with the violations of conditions of release is we don't typically prosecute violations, and so it's whether it's policy or practice, we are not seeing those violations being referred to our office. So we're not either aware and or prosecuting the violations that are conditions of release. And so there's a possibility that those cases may not get prosecuted, and we may not have a record upon which the pretrial services unit can evaluate future risk assessments for pretrial risk assessment tools. And then the last area I was asked to address were Class C felonies. I guess the first thing that this committee should be aware of is with the way that bail is set for Class C felonies, certain Class C felonies, we have a large number of offenders who are charged only with Class C felonies who are in the custody of the Department of Corrections. When we know and the defense knows that there's no way that they're going to get a sentence that will require them to be in custody for any period of time. So, for example, they may receive a probationary sentence, but they may have served 30 or 60 days before their case gets resolved or gets tried or they get bail. So you've got an unintended consequence there where people can't make bail, but they're still causing resources to be drained by the Department of Corrections. And then the other point I want to make about the Class C felonies, as an example, we've had a dramatic increase in vehicle thefts in Anchorage over the last 2 years. And we routinely interact with both victims and community organizations who don't understand why a first-time vehicle theft defendant is going to get a presumptive probationary sentence and that they aren't going to do any jail time. And so it's difficult for us to, absent some sort of an aggravating factor that might be present, for us to explain to a victim why someone stole your car, perhaps for days, perhaps for weeks, and that person's not going to spend any time in jail. Those are my comments. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Campion. Appreciate it. Mr. Skidmore.
So this is John Skidmore again, and what I would say is that the Criminal Justice Commission was directed to make recommendations to reduce recidivism, to reduce the number of people that are incarcerated at any given time in our jails all across the state. And they did this for very good reasons, right? Our jails have been a dumping ground, essentially, for people that have substance abuse issues and that have mental illness. And we don't want our jails to be dumping grounds for those folks. However, you also have to recognize that for some of those folks, they commit violent offenses. They commit offenses that have serious impacts on society as a whole, and in those circumstances, it is appropriate for there to be some amount of incarceration. And what we find is that really what this is a matter of is two things: discretion and balance. Discretion and balance. Discretion, you need to have discretion. The courts have to have the discretion to look at a particular offense, to look at a particular offender, and decide, is this someone who shouldn't be in jail and we can put on probation, or is this someone who does need some jail time? And the way SB 91 came out with Class C felonies, the judges didn't have that discretion. And that's one of the problems we ran into. We asked Mr. Campion to address some of those concepts. Now, I could go through and describe all sorts of Class C felonies. There's over 60 of them on our books, and I could give you lots of examples of Class C felonies in which you would, I think, readily agree this person should have some jail time. But what it comes back to for me fundamentally is that that balance I talk about, that discretion, that's rooted someplace. It's rooted in our laws. It's rooted in our Constitution. Article 1, Section 12. It lays out what are the competing interests of the criminal justice system. One of them is reformation, but one of them is also public safety. That's also found in our statutes. Alaska Statute 1255-005. It's also found in our cases. And there was one case in particular that I thought was worthy of highlighting for you all. It's a Supreme Court case called Lancaster. And if you'll bear with me for just a moment, there's a quote from it that's short, but that I think is very succinct and drives the point home. It reads, "Rehabilitation of the offender is, of course, an important goal to be achieved for the benefit of society and because it is a recognition of the intrinsic worth and the inherent dignity of man." That's rehabilitation. But the same opinion goes on to say, "The fact that a criminal defendant should be rehabilitated, if possible, does not mean that he should escape punishment for his misdeeds. The very opposite may be true. Penalties must be imposed, in most instances, in order to make rehabilitation effective, as well as to protect the public and deter others from engaging in criminal conduct." Those are not my words, ladies and gentlemen. Those are the words of our Supreme Court. So this concept of balance, of having discretion for the courts to look at, the tools to decide what's the right thing to do in any given case, comes from the Constitution, it comes from our statutes, and it comes from our case law.
And
so for Class C felonies...
And, Mr. Skidmore, from the legislature, because I've heard on this very committee that very balancing conversation many, many times.
I absolutely agree with you, Senator Coghill. And when I talk about the statutes, those obviously come from the legislature. You all have already passed those statutes that talk about that balance. So that is the work of this body. That is the work of this branch. And it continues to be the sorts of things that we expect this branch wants to pay attention to. So when we talk about Class C felonies, what we're really talking about is how much discretion are you going to return to the court system? The way that this came about is the Criminal Justice Commission looked at it. There was a debate based on a recommendation from the Department of Law. That debate caused the commission to recommend that the sentencing framework be from 0 to 90 days. I believe in version O, I think, is it what you all have in front of you right now, that's been enhanced to 120 days. That's really a policy call for you all to decide what's the right place to land on that. Our recommendation initially was more than 120 days. But again, that's a policy call for this committee that I think has to be made keeping in mind the Constitution, the statutes, the case law that says there has to be discretion and there has to be balance. The second area that we really looked at, aside from Class C felonies, was that we wanted to comment on today was the theft in the fourth degrees.
And Senator Meyer appropriately points out that for a first offense, for a second offense of theft in the fourth degree, that is stealing property under $250, there is no active jail time that's initially imposed. The Department of Law also saw this as a concern, and with the Department of Public Safety came forward to present a proposal. But one of the other things that happened for theft fours is not only did we limit the amount of jail time that could be imposed, but SB 91 also revoked another statute called the recidivist statute under theft three. And what that statute had said is that if you commit a third theft four within 5 years, it elevates it now to be a Class A misdemeanor. We presented this to the commission not to change what happened on the first and second times. I understand some of the community condemnation, some of the concerns about even those thefts, but the idea was these are the lowest level offenders and we ought to give them a chance. Many of them will change their ways simply with probation. So we didn't suggest changing what was the original sentence. What we suggested was trying to have some other sanction, some other response when you get to that third offense. And while we recommended reinstating that recidivist provision, what the commission passed and what they have given to you all recommending to do is that when you get to that third offense, you leave it as a B misdemeanor, and you now allow it to get what is up to the maximum of a B misdemeanor, which is 10 days. Now, under the Class C proposal for felonies, under the Theft 4 proposal for felonies, it's not the Department of Law's position that these folks should absolutely be in jail. Absolutely contrary to that, what we are proposing is that the courts have discretion. The sentencing range for both the C felonies and for Theft 4s, what we have recommended is zero to whatever other number you come up with. That doesn't mean you hit the maximum sentence for those folks. It means that's the discretion that's provided to the court system as to how to respond to this particular circumstance. That's the policy call that you're really faced with. And then the last piece that we looked at was violation of conditions release. And I had some comments that I would make on that, but quite frankly, I think that Ms. Mead eloquently spoke about violation of conditions release. Mr. Campion has eloquently spoken about the concerns with violation of conditions release. And so I think you all already understand why we feel it would be appropriate to return that to a misdemeanor. Beyond that, there are some other calls that are made in the SB 54. There's the mandatory probation for sex offenders. That's a critical component, we believe, to addressing sex offenders within our state. The language that's there is very good. There's a minor issue that the Department of Law has spotted, but that's something that we feel we can work out with the sponsor's office to get the language to the right place. The concept is a solid one. That's also a recommendation from the Criminal Justice Commission. Before I forget, on Theft 4, Senator Meyer had a question about look back. I do want to make sure that it's clear there is no look back period currently in law that says how far you go back before you say this third one would be subject to the 10 days, up to 10 days on the theft four. There is no provision for the look back. The look back that is found in SB 54 currently only applies to sentencing concepts for Class A misdemeanors. So it does not address that particular part of it. DUIs for mandatory minimums. The other question that Senator Meyer had was whether or not a mandatory minimum allows somebody to get out of jail earlier. And the answer is no, it does not. A mandatory minimum means you have to serve that and it cannot be reduced by others. That's the same concept for murder cases. When there is a mandatory minimum, that is the minimum and it can't be reduced. There's also a provision here on sex trafficking. I wasn't going to spend a lot of time on that other than to tell you that from the Department of Law's perspective, there was a loophole in SB 91 in the language that was used to modify the sex offense statutes. That was not a recommendation that came from the commission to make any changes there. That was introduced elsewhere in the legislature last year. And what SB 54 does is it actually closes that loophole. I'm happy to talk with people about exactly what that loophole is and what those things look like, but that wasn't the major policy concern that we wanted to address here today. So those are really the comments that we wanted to share with you all. I don't know if there are any questions for us from
there. Yeah, and I think I want to keep them brief, but at the same time, since they're before us, we want to go ahead and give some time. But before I do that, if I'll get to you, Senator Wilkowski, in a second. I want to make sure that the public defender gets his opportunity to get before us. And I also have the commissioner, Walt Monaghan, online. Walt, before I go to questions, are you able to join us on Friday if I run this too tight?
I believe I can, Mr. Chair. And Just need to know when.
All right. Thank you. I tried to get you in the last couple of minutes, but it looks like I'm going to run, like I do, so many things out of time. Senator Wilkowski, you had a question for the Department of Law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your testimony. Last year, I asked the former Attorney General if we could pass Senate Bill 91 and have no detriment to public safety, and he said absolutely. And I guess in retrospect, wasn't quite accurate, but we're learning, and not placing blame on anyone, because I asked every department head that question, and no one said that there were had concerns. But I want to make sure we get it right this time, and what I'm hearing from you is there are three concerns, and that's the Class C felonies. You're saying amend 1251-125E to have a presumptive term of 0 to 18 months for first-time Class C felonies? Is that one?
So through the chair, Senator Milikowski, the bill that's in front of you now proposes to have it 0 to 120 days with the possibility of suspending the additional time, so you have a total of 18 months. That's a proposal that's in front of you now. I can tell you that the Department of Law's original recommendation, we had looked at having the sentence be 0 to 18 months, but what we think is more reasonable is 0 to 12 months. Again, that's really the policy call for this committee to make.
And I would hope that when the public defender gets up here, because that was hotly debated in the commission as well. Senator Wilkowski.
And I fully understand it's a policy call, but you're in the trenches. Your people are there every day. You see people coming and going, and you see the impacts much clearer than I think anybody on this table or anybody in the legislature for that matter does. I want to know what your opinion is. Can we keep the public, are we keeping the public safer if we go with your recommendation to make it 0 to 12 months for Class C, first-time Class C felonies? And also, two other things. Other recommendation that I understand you've made is to reenact AS 1141-140A3 to allow recidivist thefts to be prosecuted at a higher level. And then making violating conditions of release of Class B misdemeanor a maximum of 10 days in jail. Those seem to be three of your main recommendations, and I'd like to hear your testimony about how, because I get it's a policy decision, but I'm basing my policy decisions on your expertise in the matter. What do we need to do to keep the public safe, in your opinion?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, let me start with Class C felonies. For Class C felonies, we arrived at a year because that is consistent with what the Commission's recommendations and what their intent originally was, trying to adjust presumptive sentencing. I appreciate the time. The quick history lesson is prior to 2005, Class C felonies and all felonies were subject to certain presumptive terms. We had the case called Blakely that came down. We had to adjust it. We created ranges. Those ranges resulted in an increased sentencing, and what the Commission tried to do was to reverse the presumptive ranges back to that 2005 level. By having only probation, you are below that 2005 level. By having it at 0 to 1 year, you would be consistent with what it previously had been in 2005, first. Second, it fits in with the other presumptive schemes for sentencing on the other offenses. A Class B for a first-time offense is 0 to 2 years. So C needs to be lower than 2 years, because that's what you get if you're there for a second. So you have to find some place in there that you're arriving at that position on. The idea that the Commission had, which is an appropriate recommendation, was to reduce the range of presumptive sentencing. This would still reduce it. It was 0 to 2. This would now make it 0 to 1. For a first-time Class C felony. So those are some of the things that we look at of how you arrive there. Beyond that, I could talk at length about Class C felonies and the types of cases that are involved in them, but a year feels right in terms of looking at all those types of offenses and the types of conduct that is classified as for Class C felonies. So that's really where that recommendation comes. I'm happy to spend more time and elaborate on it, but I am trying to be respectful of the time that's here as well. As for the other recommendations, quickly, on Theft 4, our proposal was simply to have some sanction for those repeated offenses, right? You do it once, we give you a break. You do it twice,
okay, you get a second time. But you get to that third time, you know, at some point you have to say, clearly this person hasn't gotten the message and we need to do something else. How you send that message, if it's what's in SB 54, if it's what the Department of Law had originally recommended, I don't think that's the significant point. The significant point is that there is some other sanction or penalty available. And for violation of conditions release, I think 54 follows very close in line with what the Department of Law originally recommended.
John, thank you very much. I know that we ran you from one committee to the next and right into the middle of a conversation, and there will probably be more questions. So will you be available by phone or in other ways Friday?
Yes, I am not going to be in Juneau on Friday, but I can make myself available by phone to answer any of
the questions. Mainly because we're going to run ourselves out of time, and there needs to be some more deliberation on this very point, I think, those three major points. And thank you, Mr. DA, for coming up. I want to make sure I get the right name, Clint Campion. So thank you very much. Quinlan, I run the clock really fast, but I also wanted you to have a chance to come up because, really, on the recommendations that we just talked about, I think that between the public defense and the public prosecution, you're going to see a little bit of a bookend of the discussion. And Quinlan, I know that you've been not only part of the commission like I have and Mr. Skidmore, but we've been involved in this discussion at length. But now is a time where we need to start making a policy call. Give us your testimony, please.
Thank you. My name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. I'm also a member of the Criminal Justice Commission and sat on the commission from its beginning and participated in the discussions both for the reform legislation as well as SB 54 and some of the changes that were recommended. I'm not going to get into details of the bill. I really just want to discuss the policy and happy to answer any questions. And I'll start, I think, with the biggest policy change that occurred, recommendation that we made, which was the C felony policy. The C felony policy had some very clear bases that drove the commission's work, and two of the things that were paramount, which was jail time for certain individuals actually increased their recidivism. Like, the very act of putting people in jail put the public at risk, when if you didn't put them in jail, there'd be less risk. And the other one was the concept that the actual conviction for a felony further reduces somebody's ability to rehabilitate themselves. It has barrier consequences for work, and the very label itself is often a barrier for people to get employment or rent housing, the very things that are key for rehabilitation. What I'd like to point out is that these refinements of the recommendations were not based upon any assessment that the original recommendations had failed or that they had compromised public safety and didn't achieve their goals. It really was a more complicated discussion about refining the policy based upon some input from the public as well as a contemplation of the merits of how even the scheme really turned out to be. So the original C felony policy had this idea of presumptive probation so that if you were to get that conviction and suffer the consequences of that barrier, that label, that at least you wouldn't suffer the additional barrier of having been in jail, which would further drive down your chances for rehabilitation. Through the discussions, it had been discussed about rolling it back to a year. That appeared to be not just a refinement, but an actual repudiation of the policy and roll it completely back. So you'd go right back to the situations where you get convictions and jail time, potentially in situations where you wouldn't want them. So the refinement discussion came down as like, how do we sort of mitigate, or at least from my perspective, how do you mitigate the likelihood that somebody's going to be in a situation where they'll plead to jail time for a felony when they could otherwise negotiate an agreement either without jail time or to an aggravated misdemeanor where they could participate in treatment and not potentially suffer the further consequences of that. 90 days was something I supported because I didn't think it had that pressure to reduce, compel pleas without the associated benefits of the treatment and the rehabilitation. And so that really drove the debate. With regard to the theft for policy, again, it was really just a discussion that resulted from a perception that was incorrect, that you could never go to jail for that low-level theft. That was never the case. You know, you could not go to jail for your first two, and on your third there was a suspended sentence, but your fourth, you could go to jail for a revocation of your prior. But in a discussion about sort of evening out the scheme, we discussed whether or not it was appropriate to elevate it all the way up to the higher level misdemeanor, whether or not this could be treated in a lower level situation where you're actually just imposing jail potentially on the third. I would like to note that I supported that change as well as the new misdemeanor aggravator, which again, for a second similar, would allow a more aggravated sentence rather than imposing an aggravator where you jump all the way up to a year. Again, it was an effort to refine the policy, not change it based upon any assessment that it had failed, and getting that sort of even mix right so that the policies are both effective for what the commission intended, but also sort of accommodated a community concern about community condemnation, which was a valuable part of the discussion and the input. That the one policy debate that I did not support was the changing the violating conditions of release. That, to me, the discussion was really administrative. You know, there were fixes in place that it could have accomplished the original intent and done it without making it a crime, and that we were solving administrative problems with criminal penalties. What did, in fact, mitigate that concern was the cap on the jail time. So it really is now limited to, I think, a period that was necessary to effectuate this goal of being able to arrest somebody for violating conditions and then have a bail hearing. That was always possible, and with the fix that was put in place by the court, I think that remained possible. It just never had a chance to sort of work its way through the system to get part of the daily practice and culture. The one other thing, discussion came up, the commission recommended certain that some minimum probationary period be imposed for individuals convicted of sex offenses. It was never discussed what that would be. It was left to the legislature. We had recommended a period that was sort of statistically, percentage-wise, similar to the prior policy so that it leave some discretion for the judges to impose an appropriate period of probation.
And so the provision in here is something that is appropriate, you think?
Well, I think it just leaves no discretion. I mean, you have the maximum and minimum the same. It's now just a definite term. If you're convicted of an offense, the judge has no discretion to decide what's appropriate under the circumstances. That's just what they're going to get. What I suggested was you do a similar percentage to the prior law so that there was some movement. And so the minimum would be for an unclassified 9, so it could be 9 to 15 or 6 to 10 or 3 to 5, something along those lines. It was just simply.
But to be fair, we did we changed some of the earned good time.
Yes,
that has some significant impact on that.
Correct, and that remaining the earned compliance credit, I think provided something that really furthered the rehabilitative goal. So yes, that remains, and with that in there, that is a positive inclusion to that area.
Let me go back to the C felony question and ask you about the discretion. The Department of Law had talked about the discretion and the pressure for that part, and I think that goes to some of the questions that we're asking on this committee. Is so we started off talking about 90. I was convinced that probably because of programs and the ability to hold people accountable for longer periods of times, that 120-day actually made some sense. You struggle against that. The Department of Law struggles against that. But there is a discretion in there. So from a defender's perspective, how do you see that discretion working?
Are you discussing the difference between 90 and 120 days? I think the difference between 90 and 120 days is not that great in terms of this perspective that I was looking at. I thought the discretion of up to a year really would have created the problem. So one of the things that the commission was concerned about is over the years when the laws changed with regard to sentencing, the legislature made a clear statement of intent that it would not increase the overall sentences. And what happened was the overall sentences increased when those ranges were available. And so what you see is really mission creep. The judges had the discretion, and they just kept ramping it up. In sort of a kind of an old school idea is that more jail time is more likely to produce the effect that you want. And what we find from all the data from around the country is that's not true. More jail time doesn't produce a better outcome. It doesn't produce more motivation for rehabilitation. So up to a year, that would concern me that you just start getting sentences up to a year. And I think, and why I supported the 90 days is that kept that down into a range that I think would sort of help mitigate that possibility that it goes into a direction that you ultimately would not want. 90 days, 120 days, I think those are reasonably close. And I don't think it going to 120 days would ultimately undermine the point of why I ultimately supported the 90-day policy.
So questions for Quinlan, Senator Wilkowski, and I'm going to try to reserve the last 5 minutes for the Commissioner of Department of Corrections so that he can talk to us about the fiscal note.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're this is good to see where the rub points are, and I'd really like to see some more, and I guess just a general perspective for everyone. I'd really like to look at the research myself on what sort of detriment you get how it affects recidivism for people who are in jail for 90 days, 120 days versus a year, what sort of public safety impacts there are for people who are 90 days, 120 days a year, just so we can, at least so I can weigh what that balance should be, and also what other states do in there. And I'm sure the commission probably has a lot of this.
Yeah, that was all documented by the commission. And the foundation served as it's all in there documented. That additional longer and longer jail sentences didn't produce better and better outcomes.
You could probably go on the commission's website and get some of that. But if need be, on this particular issue, we can get that in front of the committee in paper form again if you want.
Yeah, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Quinlan, I appreciate that.
Certainly.
And I think the commission did tell us when they first rolled out their recommendations to us that their recommendations were based on community condemnation and public safety concerns, very little to do with data-driven. And that's, but the reality is, without public confidence in a public safety system, the whole system of changing people's behavior might very well become undermined. And so we're into a little bit of that question mark of what do we think public condemnation will allow? What does public safety need? How do we hold people accountable and still give them the avenue to change? And for those who won't change, how do we ratchet it up to where the punishment actually fits the crime? And so that's one of the reasons I wanted to have both the Department of Law and Public Defender here the same day, because they represent two different sides to it. One of them is to bring public safety to the highest degree possible they possibly can, and we've tasked them to do that. One of them is to publicly defend people who have the constitutional right to be publicly defended and give opportunities for the very tension that we talked about, that the court case was read today, public condemnation, the need for reformation, and the need for punishment. And we're right into that area now where we're trying to figure out how many days do we get to do that. And I'm looking for that place of discretion where judges feel that it could be discretion. I don't know that we can actually get any data that will help us on this, unfortunately, because in looking at the data, they're saying the less jail time, the less recidivism under this particular cadre. And our public is not going to be satisfied with that at this point, I think. That's the issue, I think, that we're dealing with. Quinlan, thank you. And I'm sorry I have to cut us off short. If we had a five-hour meeting, we could really dig into this probably. An hour and a half seems to just really zoom by. And for every person who came here to publicly testify, I'm sorry to say I warned you, but I knew that we were probably going to get into these three policy areas in depth. It's important we do that in order to look at how the law actually works. But now I need to talk about a little bit of how the Department of Corrections is going to see the cost factor of this. And just for what it's worth, the Department of Corrections does not get to choose who shows up. between the police, the public defenders, and the Department of Law. They go to the courts, and the courts finally pass sentence, and the DOC just gets to take them. And Department of Corrections is now in that position where we're thinking about ratcheting up penalties, and we're once again going to see the difference between public safety and costs. And thank you, Quinlan, very much. And if I could just get the commissioner up and explain to me the thought process going to go into being able to where are the pivot points in this particular debate we're having now. I would imagine the C felony and the B aggravators, the B escalators are going to be the place where it will impact you the most. If you could just give us a concept of what you're going to be looking at that you can get back to us, hopefully by the end of the week, if not early next week.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dean Williams, the Commissioner of the Department of Corrections. You're exactly right. So the way that we're going to approach the fiscal note aspect of this is that what was ever taken out, what the predictions were, and what the estimations were under Senate Bill 91 under this class of now reintroducing jail time or potential jail time, we're going to put that back in. So that would be cost drivers in terms of increasing incarceration and increasing our cost. I guess I'll just mention a couple things to consider on the policy issues, and I'm not advocating. These are policy calls. We all struggle with what the right thing to do. And you're all facing issues like, is this a data call, a research-based call, or is this trying to figure out how to implement it better and deal with some of the perceptions of what this bill is, true or not true? Everyone who comes back to us with health care kit costs and issues that I get concerned about, even taking someone back in for 20 days or 15 or 20 days. I mean, that's just the reality of it. One of the other pieces of justice reform, which we haven't talked about, that has happened in other states, is the issue of what you do with the track three. So if you're not going to, you're going to lock them up because they need to be locked up, and that's one thing, right? You've owned the cost of that and the expense of that, and you said, yep, because they're a risk to us. They're someone who should be in jail. The other option is, no, let's not get them in jail because policy and research says if we can avoid that, they have a better chance of not getting further deeper into the system. This is the whole issue of even being 3 days in jail. There's a whole effort around the country called 3 days count or 3 days matter. The point is, if you're in jail 3 days, you could lose a lot of things. You can lose your home, you can lose your housing in 3 days, you can lose your job in 3 days. And so when you make a decision to lock someone up, it should be really, you should know what you really want to make a careful, study decision. But the other thing they haven't talked about, and we don't, it's just to mention, is that the treatment opportunities that we have of developing the third track and whether or not we put enough into that as a state. Is probably something we should contemplate, because what is in fact cheaper than what costs $150 a bed, average cost in my facilities, is whether or not we have other options to get people, to divert people, because a lot of the crime issues, I can tell you, and I'm sure the prosecutors and law enforcement, and certainly from where we stand, is related to this opioid crisis we have in the state. And so really addressing that as part of the policy call, I hope that's not lost in the discussion. I know these are difficult decisions, and I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for addressing them.
Thank you, Commissioner, and I appreciate that. I was remiss in noticing that Representative Reinbold had been sitting with us for some time, and I appreciate that. And we will continue the discussion on Friday, and if we need to, we'll continue the discussion the following Monday. But what I'd like for members to do is consider and converse with the affected people, and we'll have some public testimony. In fact, there's nothing to make. And I remember before I was a legislator, it irritated me that I would sit in committees and listen to the professionals talk, and I could not get in on the conversation as a private citizen. I want to make sure I don't throttle that opportunity back. But we needed to get the context out of the policy call before I think we had that discussion in earnest, so that people know exactly where the big policy questions are. So my intention is Friday to make sure I have ample opportunity for people to testify and make their comments known. And then we'll get into some of the discussion. I would hope that you'd be available by phone, all members of the administration, so that we can call upon you. And Mr. Monaghan, you will be the first person up to testify from the professionals, and my apologies for having you hang on, but I wanted you also to hear the questions that we were asking so that when it comes your turn to speak, you can step right into that conversation so that we can understand your perspective better. So my apologies to everybody who showed up that didn't get a chance to speak. Maybe we should do a seven-hour meeting. No. The answer is no, Senator Coghill.
Yeah, you'll have
to all concerned and to the commission that has been quoted often, my deepest gratitude to all concerned. There's working for a better and safer Alaska. Hopefully Senate Bill 54 will get its traction and move on. With that, we'll be ready. If you want amendments to be considered, I would encourage you to try to notify me in my office so that I can be prepared to give ample time for the discussion on them, please. All right. Thank you. With that, we're going to adjourn the Judiciary Committee at 3:01.